We're in the studios of Interlochen Public Radio today talking about a great new book that's just been published called Strings Attached. Steve and Mary, I want to throw a question out to you. So, Mary, how do we help young teachers understand that their need to adapt to, not necessarily in terms of standards or expectations, but how they learn to teach and to coach and differentiate their instruction as the world's values and social mores change? And I want to throw that question to you as a teacher educator, and conversely, Steve, I'd like you to think about how does that happen in the world of business? Because I can assure you that the young people that you were bringing in and mentoring at Ogilvy had a very different view of how things ought to be than you did. So Mary, let's go to you. How do we help emerging young teachers understand that their life is going to span, we hope, 30 to 40 years, although the research is saying teachers are spending less time fully engaged in their craft just because they're burning out. How do we help them understand that they start at point A in 2013, but they're going to end up in point B in 2040? It's going to be a very different world.
Yeah, and actually, between point A and point B, often there are many other stops. So point B becomes point X.
Yeah, right.
And so it's a very much a changing world. As young teachers go into a school, they can already see the spectrum of teachers, because within an individual school, you'll have young teachers, you'll have teachers who have been in the practice for up to 10 years, but you'll also have some teachers who have been there for 28 years or for a longer period of time and are actually approaching their retirement years. So students, young teachers who go into schools can see this spectrum, and they can see that what they're learning in their college classes today maybe isn't being practiced in the schools. And so a big challenge for them is how to make some changes even today that will bring the educational system more up to what's possible in today's world versus what was the practice 30 years ago, and then at the same time to look at what was the practice 30 years ago and what we need to preserve of that practice. Mm-hmm. And I think we're talking about some of the things here that need to be preserved, the valuing of the students. And there actually is research that shows that when a teacher believes that a student can learn and has confidence in the student learning, that the student actually does learn mm-hmm. more frequently than when the teacher says, well, these children really can't learn. And so how to bring all of these pieces together and make 21st century changes throughout a school, that's maybe as much the challenge as trying to prepare students today for what life will be like 30 years from now. And so I guess the best way to prepare them for what will the teaching world be like is to help them remain open-minded and to help teachers themselves be continuous learners mm-hmm. so that they don't get stuck in a particular practice, but they're open to possibilities.
I want to go to Steve on that question. I want to throw out something I learned yesterday. We were interviewing for another feature here at Interlochen Public Radio, a museum director at one of our most distinguished museums, who said that he, in order to help his staff understand young museum goers, pairs them with young millennials, and they shadow each other and look at how they communicate and respond. And I think that's a process of mentoring, which I think in this day of rapid change and our young people have such different ways that they communicate is not a bad idea. Steve, looking at the corporate side, how do we prepare people to understand that the difference between point A and point X is it's a continuum, and how
it
do you,
is indeed. And yeah. What I've always tried to do is teach adaptive communication, because dealing worldwide, there are so many different cultures. You know, China is very different from Japan, is very different from India, is very different from France. So how can you not be the ugly American and try to figure out how to communicate as effectively as possible, given your audience. Mm-hmm. And there also is the millennial age difference. their values, their work styles, which is not to say they don't work very, very hard. You really can't be in my business and not work hard. Now, one other thought occurred to me, and that is, at the end of the day, what Mr. K was all about was teaching children to create beauty. You know, that was the goal. And ultimately in life, that's our goal. When you know, you can have a beautiful hedge fund. You can have a beautiful medical discovery. You can have
a beautiful magazine.
A beautiful magazine. Right. You can have that perfect note. And that's why you try to continually raise the bar. And if that entails, you know, getting hit with the occasional baton, okay, bring me along.
Yeah. You know, I'm a little bit struck here is that people responded differently to Mr. K at the end of his life at the memorial service. And I think that sometimes the value of time and distance and our own wisdom and growth allows us to appreciate people in reverse at a different level. And sometimes you can't say thank you because they die. But do we have a problem as a society in thinking back to those people? I think back to my seventh grade science teacher who really was the one who taught me to write and to think. Dervin Garrison. And when I was about 40, I was asked a question, boy, you're a really good writer. How did you develop that? And I know that my mother was a writer and writing was a big thing in our house. But when I really think of who, of course, I rejected anything that she told me. But when I think of who really helped me, it was the seventh grade teacher. And I actually still had those papers. And I went back, went home and dug them out, you know, some box in the basement and realized what he had said in there and what I had done, and I wrote him a note, and he wrote back and said I was in tears. We don't really thank our people who've been powerful in our lives enough, do we? Joanne, and then Mary.
So strings attached essentially is a thank you to,
right,
not just to Mr. K, I mean, it, you know, from us to Mr. K, but really it is a thank you to teachers and mentors. And as I was saying earlier, it's the story of one man, but it's really a universal story that it's a story about all of us, because just about everyone you meet, once you tell them, you know, this story, people who have read the book, the most frequent response we've had from people who have read Strings Attached is, I finished the last page, tears streaming down my face, I closed the book, I picked up the phone, and I called my fifth grade teacher. And that's the most gratifying response you could possibly hope for, is to have people kind of be reminded of those mentors in their lives, the teachers who made all the difference,
right,
for them.
You know, there was a lot of research in the 80s and 90s when we were really focusing on quality and excellence and how do we keep teachers in the profession. And Mary, I think you may remember this research that said that teachers value praise and thanks from former students more than salary increases. That remuneration to them is both an issue of thank you as well as it is compensation. So how do we develop those systems, Mary, that would allow us to say thank you to people who were really seminal mentor shapers of our lives?
Well, I think that is really meaningful to a teacher when a student comes back or has a chance meeting and suddenly they remember what the teacher has provided to them in their lives, and the teacher, it spurs the teacher on. So it's really very important to see the lasting impact over the years. How do we get people to do it? Well, I know that in some meetings that I've been participating in, not only meetings that are education related, but other kinds of things, people actually pass out notes and say, write a note to a teacher that has meant something to you in your past. Mm-hmm. And how do we do it? I mean, maybe in general, making us all take a little bit more time to be appreciative of the people in our lives and to recognize the contributions. But that calls for reflection and time to kind of think about, how did these pieces come together? Who really were the influences in our lives? And teachers have a tremendous impact that is a lasting impact, and lots of times never know what that impact has been on their students.
Well, that, you know, there's research out that says that that entry-level teachers right now are staying in classrooms about 5 years is all, which is pretty shocking. And here, you know, my dad taught for 40 years. Jerry Kupchinski taught for practically 40 years. Those days are over. So do you think this book is going to start kind of a wave of people really understanding the role of teaching? They're not going to take it for granted. I just came from China where the reaction to me being there to visit with parents and former students was just such a deep respect for what we had done. And the feeling was totally different than it is in this country. So Melanie, Joanne, maybe reflect on that. Steve, we can all jump in here.
I'd like to just jump in quickly and say I had exactly the reaction that Joanne described when I finished the last page of Strings Attached. And of course, you know, when you mentioned your English teacher, I thought immediately of Claire Kleinschmidt, who taught me how to write at Interlaken at the tender age of 15. And was the toughest grader I had ever had. She'd make these little red marks through your essays and take off points. She had some system. And she was terrifying to me and most of her students. But when I look back on that, by the time I was doing papers in college, I had real gratitude. And I wish I had sent her that thank you note that Mary mentioned, because she made a tremendous difference in my life.
Joanne, Melanie?
I think my dad was really gratified to see how many of his students didn't just thank him verbally, but actually went on to pass on what he had taught them to their own children or to others. He sent out an awful lot of teachers out of his program, a lot of music teachers. But beyond that, I think even someone like Joanne, who didn't go on to teach music or play music, but she passed on her love of music and the things that she learned from my dad that were valuable about playing an instrument onto her own children. And I think many of his students were able, we heard from one student who she had put her instrument away to raise her kids. And when her daughter got to high school, they needed violins in the pit orchestra at the school. And the mom went into the pit with her daughter, and the daughter was at first mortified. And then all the kids in the pit were saying, wow, your mom is really cool. And by the end of the 4 years of high school, she'd been in that pit for all 4 years. And she and her daughter were really close again. And she wrote to us and told us this story. And I think that kind of story is the greatest thanks my father could ever have.
Mm-hmm. Joanne,
the one thing that that really struck me was that it wasn't until I heard of Mr. K's passing that it hit me how important he was to me. And I think he knew it. I think he knew. You know, he taught me. He taught my sisters. All of us. One of my sisters became a music teacher, and all three of us, all of our children collectively, all play instruments. One of them went on to become a professional horn player. So I think that he understood the gratitude. But I also feel that sometimes you don't know until later. I think it's particularly with a very demanding mm-hmm. teacher like Mr. K and like so many of these others we've heard about. It's really tough at the time, and it's only later that you really are so grateful mm-hmm. for the lessons they taught you.
Right. One thing that I'm thinking here as we think about the purpose of education, and we've talked about, Mary has championed this, arts is a complete education, and it's an intrinsic part of education in Florida, and she's championed that here. We've heard that across the country. And somebody made a comment once that the real purpose of education in this country is to teach you how to continue to learning, that it gives you a series of parameters and compass points that you can fall back on in later life. And I'm going to throw that out to all of us to think about. Is that really the purpose of education? In this case, that's the real role and value of having the arts education in our schools. It allows that complete view of a full compass of options to us. Let's start with you.
Well, I think that we certainly want that full view of what is possible, and our feeling here is the idea that arts education, and specifically music education, is really critical to having that complete education. And in the work I'm doing now with the area of arts integration, that's what we're trying to do, is bring the arts into the total curriculum of a school so that the arts are infused throughout other subject areas. So as you're studying history, you're simultaneously engaged with the arts to form what the context of that history is, and you're having those kinds of experiences. But you talked about the continuation of learning, and of course, that's, I think, what we really have to do. And so as we think about the education of teachers, teachers are in school for 4 years, and then they might teach for 40 years, but if all they learn is in that 4 years when they're in college, they don't have enough to sustain them through 40 years. So teachers really must be lifelong learners and continue to change in order to the needs of what today's students are doing and how the world is changing. So this idea of the arts completing education is really a critical one.
Steve, Joanne, Melanie, jump in.
Well, I was thinking, you know, I know so many people in other fields who have a music background, and Yale, for example, Yale School of Music is wonderful, but many of those students do not go on to music careers. They go on to other professions, and I think that's that idea of lifelong learning, stay interested, stay active, stay engaged, with culture, with your community, learn something new all the time, I think is absolutely the purpose of a great education.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Joanne?
I think playing an instrument... Oh,
yeah.
Sorry.
No, please, Molly, go ahead. Yeah.
I think playing an instrument and studying music teaches you to use your brain in different ways than other subjects do. And I think that opening up those pathways really helps you with all your interactions with people, and when you play together, you bond with people, but you also learn to read people, and you learn to sense things about what's going on around you. You get a heightened awareness, and I think those are very valuable things that you get, and those can be carried on, of course, forever, out way past your school days.
Well,
I couldn't agree with you more. You know, the word harmonize comes to mind. I said ensemble playing teaches you literally to play well with others, but actually, you know, getting the left and right sides of the brain wired a little differently through music is a great way to harmonize with others.
It's really Daniel Goleman's emotional intelligence argument that there's this whole side of us that we have to be successful, whether we go on in the arts or we go on into business or any. It's that ability to relate and create that emotional intelligence that allows us to function. Joanne?
Yes, Steve makes a fantastic point. And in fact, in writing Strings Attached, I kept noticing, as we were working on the book, I kept noticing that there were all of these really outstanding people in other fields who had started out as musicians, including Steve.
Mm-hmm.
I later went and interviewed them, including Steve, and wrote about this for the New York Times. And I was fascinated when you talk to highly successful people who started out as musicians, and they talk about the left side, right side of the brain, and maybe not in so many words, but for instance, Paul Allen, who was the co-founder of Microsoft, talks about how for him music is the flip side of his programming brain. And he started out as a violinist and switched to guitar, became a rock and roll guitarist. And he talked about how in the early days of Microsoft, he would program for 12 and 14 and 16 hours, and he'd come home at 3 a.m. and he'd pick up the guitar. And he said it was like the emotional analog to, you know, one to the other. And he talked about how, you know, basically for both, you learn the basics and then you use those basics to then create something new, whether it's programming or music. And he said the music helps you kind of open up these pathways to creativity, which I thought was a fascinating way of describing it.
Right. We were talking last night at dinner about the link between music and medicine, and the number of people in medical schools who have had strong musical backgrounds, and my own experience at the University of Minnesota, where I was treated for this problem multiple times. All the residents wanted to talk about with me was music. When they found out I ran a music school, they were interested in talking about my case, which was actually pretty dire. So,
and then there's
you know,
go ahead, Melanie.
When you said that people who go into medicine, the highest percentage of a single group, the highest percentage are students who have music degrees that go into medicine, even higher than the percentage of students who have a pre-med background.
Right. Melanie?
I was just going to say that here in Chicago, we have a lawyer-attorney orchestra, an orchestra made up entirely of attorneys.
Oh, boy. I wonder who gets to sit first. And
and I know Google had an orchestra also.
Yeah.
I mean, there's certainly a connection that's been proven between math and music.
Right.
The math brain and music brain. But there's also just, I think it's all of these people I spoke to for this New York Times piece and also the people we spoke to for Strings Attached, there's clearly a way that music develops your brain that helps you think and process differently, listen to people. You know, as Steve says, the ensemble playing helps you play well with others in whatever field, if you're in the office or if you're in an orchestra. Mm-hmm. But clearly music helps you process, helps the brain kind of process things in a different way.
Yes. Steve?
You know, all this conversation reminds me about an anecdote I once heard. Albert Einstein played the violin, and one time Yasha Heifetz was going through Princeton and decided to stop for a cup of tea and play a duet. And after a few moments, Heifetz turned to Einstein and said, "Professor, you can't count."
That's a great story.
But you know, Joanne's piece in the New York Times, which raised the issue of a lot of people who have music in their background and actually rather quiet about it. You know, Larry Page from Google was a saxophonist and jazz musician, and others that are there, and countless others that aren't there. Are we afraid to talk about that? Is that something we kind of keep in our personal lives backed up, you know, kind of locked up?
You know, I was fascinated when 60 Minutes did a piece about the movie Lincoln, and they mm-hmm. interviewed Steven Spielberg, and he started talking about how all of his movies come out of his childhood, interest from his childhood. And what he said was, and I'm paraphrasing, but it was essentially what he said was, and I was the outsider. I was the kid who played the clarinet mm-hmm. in the orchestra.
Yeah.
And I think there was a bit of that kind of stigma. And one of the things with Strings Attached that's been so delightful to see is people like owning it. Like, yeah, you know, I play the oboe. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
It's because it really is. I think it's a point of pride for so many people.
Melanie, I'm just really curious. How did your dad broker the coaches at East Brunswick High School, and how did he, you know, there's the nerd culture, the music culture, the jock culture. How did he? I'm just curious how he fit in with that as we talk about acceptance. You know.
Well, my dad was the supervisor of music for the entire school system as well as the conductor of the orchestra, so he was in charge of the marching band. And I remember very clearly him telling us, he didn't direct it, but he oversaw everything. And I remember him telling me that people wouldn't blink an eye at paying a fee to go hear the band at a football game. But then when they charged their $2 or whatever for a ticket to the spring concert of the orchestra, people were all upset. And I think he really felt some rivalry there with that. You know, his first job was as a marching band director, and he took the kids around and they played at the games and at the bridge opening and in competitions. And I think he made peace with whoever he had to make peace with to get what he wanted accomplished.
Yeah, I'm just curious about because schools do have distinctive cultures of acceptance, and certainly here at Interlochen, we see students who weren't accepted who come here to an arts place and our home because they're with other artists and other teenage artists. So, Mary, how do we break those cultural stereotypes down? I mean, there's a lesson here of powerful lessons that you're going to learn discipline whether you're learning to kick the football and run laps or you're playing Kreutzer sonatas and learning scales and arpeggios.
I think breaking the stereotypes is actually tough, and I think getting the conversation open so that people do own their musicianship and their background in music will actually help that. I'm reminded of when I was teaching in a little town in Illinois. I taught K K-12 music, and I got to my high school mixed chorus, and there were no men in the chorus. And I said, I thought this was mixed chorus. And the girls all said, oh, well, we never have boys in the chorus. And so I thought, well, we're going to now. And I went to around the school, and I recruited all of the football players to be in the chorus, because that was, I kind of knew that they had some status in the school, and they actually could sing and learn to sing and really developed their love of music. And I think that's what we have to do. We have to break down some barriers ourselves, so that people who are not in our circles, like the music circle, we invite them in and let them have a place. Because I think sometimes people look at musicians, they look at the music world, and they think, I really know nothing about that. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to enter in. And so while we give outlets to people, like the attorney's orchestra, we give outlets to people that have a music background, maybe throughout our lives we need to continue to nurture and develop adult learning in music, so that then they can help us also break down these barriers. So it isn't just for teachers, it's really kind of part of our society.
Right. I think there's a pop culture element here that, mm-hmm. that's really important to kind of tap into pop culture. Melanie and I, in Writing Strings Attached, like the first thing we said is, this is a book for everyone. This is not a book that's just for musicians,
yeah,
or people
absolutely.
Who took music right. lessons. And because those lessons are for everyone. And, you know, you see, and I think that's a step, and we need more steps of that sort. I mean, the show Glee, you know.
Oh, I was
chorus,
thinking of Glee, too.
Much more
thinking
acceptable,
of it
but and in New York, where I'm from, there's a couple of young chamber groups that very intentionally, like, they dress in their black T-shirts,
yep.
they play outside, they got they're hip, you know, they're like hipsters who happen to be brilliant Juilliard trained musicians. So I think that it's really, and they are doing it very intentionally, those
mm-hmm,
musicians,
right.
to break into, to make music part of the popular culture and make it feel more comfortable for more people.
Well, there was the Disney show High School Musical. Maybe we need high school orchestra. We need to make this more glamorous. I want to go back to the strength, and I think we can look all around the country at these very strong, iconic figures who came out after World War II and built these remarkable programs in various cities across the country. And we can talk about Waukegan, Illinois, and Joliet or Quincy, and we can talk about Williamsport, Pennsylvania, East Brunswick, New Jersey. What happens when those characters go? And I know I asked Joanne this last night at dinner. After Jerry retired, and I know one of his former students continued, is the program still strong today? Has it left an expectation, Melanie, in the community that, boy, we're never going to let this go away?
I think it did. I think that not only did he train up a lot of his people who came after him that took over, but he was mentor to some of the other ones. So if he wasn't their actual teacher, he was their mentor. And I think that the program is still strong. I'm not sure exactly right now this minute, but I'm pretty sure that it, for a long time afterwards, the orchestra continued to grow, and they actually came out here to the Midwest convention, and I played with them. I did the Bach double with one of my other former colleagues and friends, and they were giant. They were huge. I think the orchestra's flourishing, absolutely flourishing.
That's great. And because sometimes those larger-than-life figures, there are just kind of like, sometimes they're so powerful that in a community that the school administration doesn't want that kind of a power figure. They want somebody who will be less, who will be more pliable.
Oh, no. They built a beautiful performing arts center after my father retired, and I think things are going along swimmingly there. I think he laid the foundation for something that's going to go on for a long time.
So what would Jerry Kupchinski think today of young teachers? And if he were plopped in an orchestra with a young novice teacher, 23, 24, just starting out, how would watched over a period of time, how would he help that person understand who he is and develop a mentorship with that person?
Well, my father was quite conscious of his role in the community. I think he felt really compelled to reach out around him at all times and make sure that he was he loved to be in the paper. He liked to get his program out in front of the audiences. He took us to the elementary schools. And I think he would stress to a young teacher that when one of your most important resources is your community, and that you really want to make sure your presence is known. He was very, very big on and contributing, playing in the hospitals and the schools, and making interactions with the other, you know, with the other departments and things like that.
Yeah, very important. Joanne, what do you think? Because you knew him. Yeah.
He was so demanding and strict with us as a conductor. He used to say, orchestra is not democracy, is benign dictatorship, and it was. And I think that there are probably young teachers who are reluctant to assert that authority. And I think one of the things he would do is actually, by example, assert that authority.
Mm-hmm. Mary and Steve, Mary, there was a book out. Dr. Conway from Michigan wrote a book, the whole thing on music mentorship. How do we get career teachers who are leaving the profession to give back to these young people who need role models? One of the problems of early retirement programs is that a lot of the senior leadership have been encouraged to leave. And, you know, schools are tough today, so they've taken that. But it doesn't leave a lot of strong mentors left. How do we encourage that through our professional organizations or colleges of education? Because I think it's really important.
I think it's really important, too. And one of the ways that the Florida Music Educators Association is doing this is through the development of an emerging leaders program. And so we are taking young teachers or teachers who are emerging as leaders at a later stage in their careers, but we're forming a group of those people and connecting them with some of the fine resources of our retired educators who have been leaders or of currently serving educational leaders, so that they have that kind of mentorship at a level that might not otherwise be available to them. But I think the ongoing mentorship of teachers is really a very critical thing until they establish their roots, until
right.
they really know what to do. Because what Mr. K was doing with these community relations, for instance, is really critical to advocacy for music education and to bringing communities together with the schools to support that development. So this is a really important area that I think we all can continue to work on.
Steve, what about the business world?
Oh, first of all, so much of this comes down to an issue of money and funding.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you're choosing between textbooks and clarinets, you know, the textbooks usually win. But I think the message in Strings Attached and the op-ed pieces that Joanne has done for the Washington Post, the New York Times, and I'm sure others will come, to get the message to parents that this arts education is really important to the long-term success of your children. So it is important, and I think that, you know, getting that word out to parents and to the business community is one of the best ways to keep these people in their jobs, to keep these good teachers teaching, and to get the kind of community support necessary for the programs to flourish.
You know, the period of 60s and 70s has often been called the golden age of public school music.
Yes.
And it was before Nation at Risk, before we went, you know, pell-mell into this high stakes, high testing culture. At the same time, we've seen this incredible increase in the mass of musical media available to people, musical information. What you can do with GarageBand on an iPad today is really, it's scary. But I think because there's all this access that, as I've worked with music and arts educators, I've often used the statement that the more pervasive music has become in our culture, the less valued the study of music has become in our schools, which is a horrible thing to say, but I think if you look at it exponentially, that's true. What do we learn from this book that will help us counter that? Because I think we're seeing here on many different levels that there are vast lessons that come from this that do help shape strong people, characters, strong citizen leaders, strong advocates for the arts, people who are enriched by beauty. How do we get this message across to more people? And I'll start with Joanne, who I hope continues to write all these powerful articles about this in the New York Times and Wall Street Journal books.
Melanie and I have been so encouraged by the response to Strings Attached because, we wanted to tell the story of the importance of mentors. And he happens to be a music teacher. The music, both messages have really seemed to have touched a chord, have really reached people. And the response to the music piece that you're talking about on music education has been really powerful.
Yeah,
so, we need to work to continue to get that message out. I think the whole book is basically an example of the power of music education and what it does for people.
So do people like you and Steve who are influenced by music and are not, like Mary, teaching it and Melanie playing it, do you become even more critical than music teachers today?
What this book has done for me personally actually has brought me back in touch, of course, with Melanie, which was awesome because we were very close as kids and then didn't see each other for decades. But what the book has done for me is really reconnected me with music and made me realize how important music is in my life and made me much more conscious about that. And I think that we're hearing that from others as well. And that's what I was talking about earlier, where there's all these people who are coming out of the woodwork. There's the people I spoke with in the New York Times, everybody from Woody Allen to Alan Greenspan of the Federal Reserve Board, but also all sorts of other people who are reminded of the power of music in their own lives and how important it was in shaping them.
Right. Steve?
I would say, the message that, and I certainly got this out of Strings Attached, is the importance of creating beauty yourself. Mm-hmm. In other words, not just plugging in the iPad or iPod, but actually playing music. And that used to be, in our home growing up certainly, music was central. The piano would be played every single night. There would be a performance of some kind. We even once hosted the Hibernia Hour with an Irish fiddler and folk dancers. But it was in the home. And what's interesting to me is, looking at China, they seem to be where the U.S. was in about 1890, where classical music was just exploding all over the place, and every kid was getting music lessons of one kind or another.
Yeah, it is, having just come back from China, it's interesting that in this country we are just on a mania right now in math and science and high-stakes testing, and China has completely reversed itself, and now its whole message, which schools are scrambling, is how do we get more liberal arts, creative, collaborative education in Chinese schools? So clearly we need a population exchange.
Somebody told me this, and I don't know if it's true, that there are more people studying the piano in China than the entire population of Austria.
Oh, that's true. Melanie, there's 70 million kids playing the clarinet in China.
That's
amazing.
There
are 120 million violinists and 170 million pianists.
Wow.
And
part
of this is that, there's an even more interesting aspect is the importance of creativity. In other words, you can make things better, cheaper, faster, and that'll only get you so far. Until you can actually have creativity in the economy, in business, you're not going to become a truly great power.
Well, friends, this has been an absolutely fascinating interview, and we are going to have so much great material to share with our colleagues in and out of the arts and in and out of the music across the country. Joanne Lippman and Melanie Kupchinski, the authors of Strings Attached, new released and Taking the Country by Storm. Steve Hayden, former executive vice chairman of Ogilvy Mather. Mary Palmer, arts educator in Orlando, Florida. Thank you for joining us here at Interlochen Public Radio.
Thank you so much for having us.
This has been a special production of Interlochen Public Radio. The executive producer of this production was Tom Paulson, and this program was produced by Brock Mormon. For more information about the book Strings Attached, please go to the website stringsattachedbook.com. For more information about Interlochen Center for the Arts, visit our website, interlochen.org. From Interlochen Center for the Arts, I'm Jeff Kimpton, thanking you for joining us today.